I think my purpose is to help people understand that the strength mostly comes from the mental, you know, like that has been kind of like the overarching, theme of most of the answers to this question today, you know, really realizing that if you don't believe in yourself, one, no one else is going to, and also you'll never actually reach your full potential. So I think with coaching and powerlifting and everything that I do, basically my whole purpose is to help people realize that your strength starts in your brain and you can't actually express it physically unless you're able to hone in on that mentally.
Welcome to the future is female powerlifting. A show where women of all strengths can explore the world of female powerlifting. I am your host, Heidi Donnell, a 60-kilo powerlifting gym owner, and each episode we bring you an inspiring interview or message to help you unlock your true inner strength potential. Thanks for tuning in. Aloha, my beautiful friends, and welcome back. We are on episode 71, and, you know, I don't know if you all know this, but this is my 3-year anniversary. What? It's 3 years. Can you imagine that? 3 years since I started the very first episode, which some of you might know, I actually kind of screwed up. And I talk about this, you know, like talk about pushing through questionable times and times when you're like, oh, I shouldn't be doing this. That definitely happened to me on my very first episode. And I really questioned, should I even be doing this? I screwed up the very first episode, but you know, something new, I never did it before. And I'm really damn proud that my husband told me, Heidi, don't be ridiculous. Just do it again. And here we are 3 years later and kicking off our very first episode for our 3-year anniversary is Coach Riley Presnell of Habitual Strength. You may know Riley as a powerlifting coach, but she is also the co-owner of Culture Nutra, the co-host of the Strength and Success podcast that she hosts with Trevor, an international elite powerlifter and a WRPF state judge. Like, talk about a woman who is pushing powerlifting. I love this episode today because Riley and I get to dive into some questions that were asked on our Instagram. Whenever you see the golden mic on our Instagram, know that that means that you have the opportunity to ask questions, a Q&A with our guest, whoever the person will be popping on that day. And we had some wonderful questions and Riley went down and kind of looked through all these questions and said, hey, let's go for these ones right here. So we are going to be answering the following questions today. One, how did you become a coach and what was the process you did to grow your community? Two, mindset for moving on after a bad meet. At what point in your powerlifting journey did you see a huge leap in strength gains and what do you attribute it to? What is one of the most helpful things to improve sumo deadlifts? What would you implement for a new lifter that has issues flaring their elbows out in the press motion of the bench? And what is your purpose? Wonderful questions. And I want to give a big shout out to those of you who have left a review on iTunes, who leave screenshots for me. You send them to me on Instagram whenever you're listening to the show. Thank you so much. And if you notice, anytime I get those, I repost those and share them with our guests because let me tell you, they love that. And I want to give a little shout out to Kelly, 1983, which I think is my friend Kelly who I lifted with. I am not sure. I would say she was born in 1983. This possibly could be her, but she left a review saying, wealth of knowledge. I'm so glad I came across this podcast as a novice powerlifter. Heidi is so easy to listen to. I learned so much and been inspired by the stories and missteps of Heidi and her guests. Love the What Was I Thinking segment. Always excited to listen to each new podcast. Thank you, Kelly. And for any of you out there who have a few minutes, take some time out today and just go leave us a review. And if you are looking to improve your powerlifting, if you're looking to get stronger, if you don't know where to start, this episode is brought to you by my gym, Core Strength and Performance, where we live through strength. Visit core256.com to learn more about what we offer and how we can help you. Now, let's get it started with Riley.
That's what's important. You know, like even if it's a high level meet, as long as you're having a good time, you're going to have a good meet. Because even if you won't, let's say you went 6 for 9, it wasn't your best day, you'll remember having fun.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you may not remember that you went 6 for 9, but you'll remember having fun.
Yeah, exactly. And in the end, I was like cheering everybody on. And it's definitely one of those nice experiences. And the meet was great. It was only 2 flights. The next day was 3 flights. And then after that, it was 4 flights per day. But I was like, it's fucking awesome. We were done by like 2 o'clock.
So early. Yeah. I remember her being like, and I'm done. And I was like, wow, that's great.
Yeah. I didn't even have enough time to eat. Like I brought food and everything. I was like, I can't eat this now. Like I don't have even with our 20 minute breaks, like I really don't have enough time to like eat this and kind of go right into the next thing without possibly puking on the platform here.
Right.
Yes. But yeah, I'm super excited to have you here. And of course, like this is kind of how it happens. Like we just roll into it and have fun with it. And I loved watching you at the showdown. I've never seen you compete. And it's always impressive to me when I see a lifter who you looked very composed, very put together. You lifted well, but I know you said that it wasn't like what the performance you wanted, but you went for it anyway. What were you expecting from the showdown? Like what didn't go as planned for you?
So it was my first time actually like cutting weight for me. Like I generally had just walked in at whatever I weighed in at, like my first couple of meets, I was a 181 competitor and I pretty much weighed 180. And then when I switched to 165, I walked in at 160. So my weight has always been kind of a little bit below where I needed to be for the top end of the weight class. With this one, I was like, I want a little bit of a challenge. Like I had been consistently training around 155 or so. And I was like, I could eat up into the 165. So I was like, or I could give myself a new challenge and go down to 148.
Yeah.
And I know my body pretty well. And I know that I can fluctuate some pounds like pretty easily with just a little bit of manipulation. And then obviously I have Trevor that's very knowledgeable. So he was like, we can do a water cut and, you know, you'll swing like maybe 5 pounds from that. And if you have to sweat a little bit, you can do that. No big deal. I was like, okay, let's do it. You know, like no better time to try than now. And we started doing the water load and everything and started depleting out my carbs, depleting out the sodium and everything. And I weighed in on Saturday. I was on weight by Wednesday. So I was at 148 on Wednesday and I was like, oh man, that kind of dropped off a little bit faster than I wanted it to, you know? And I was like, well, you know, what do we do here? I was like, should I like manipulate anything? And he's like, well, you know, if we manipulate and start adding things back in, you run the risk of holding too much and then you're going to be overweight. He's like, so we just have to let it run the course now. Like it kind of is what it is. We'll run the course. He's like, the main thing that changes is that the night before weigh-ins, you'll be able to eat, you know, like a lot of competitors that do big cuts the night before weigh-ins there, they stop drinking water at like noon the day before. They don't eat dinner and things like that. We went out to a hibachi place and I played it safe. And Jen Rotsinger and I, we both ate chicken and veggies. We just asked them to not put any butter on it or anything like that. No salt. So we both ate chicken and veggies. I got to drink water up until the night before, you know, just sipping here and there, not chugging gallons of water or anything. But the next day I weighed in at 145. I was like, man, I was like, I was pretty light.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. So for future, we know that I can swing pretty well, but you know, he competed on Saturday. And so I stayed with him on Saturday to help him. And I would not change a thing about that. Like it may have impacted my performance a little bit being there all day at the meet, maybe not refeeding as well as I wanted to, but I wouldn't change anything about that. He had a great day and that's fine with me. I'm very happy for that.
Yeah.
So, but it can be exhausting being at a meet all day, you know, and maybe not getting all the food in that you want to. So I didn't weigh myself the morning of the meet to see what I had gotten back up to, but I didn't feel full. You know, I didn't feel like what I was walking around at like 154, 155. And I was like, that's fine. We're just going to go and give it what we got and we'll see.
Right.
For the meet day, I was projecting somewhere around like 390 to 400 for squats. Bench was about 220 and deadlifts. I was projecting 490 to 500. So on meet day, I ended up actually only getting my opening squat, which was 358. So significantly lower. Bench went great. I somehow managed to always go 3 for 3 on bench
awesome.
Meets. And that seems to be the elusive third bench press that no one can ever get. Somehow that's the only thing that I get.
You're looking at her. I don't even know when the last time I got my third was.
I have always gotten my third bench.
That's fantastic.
So I'm sure I just jinxed myself.
Right.
But, you know.
I'll knock on wood.
And I ended up only getting my opening deadlift at 451. And it just, so I didn't bomb, which is great. Right. I went 5 for 9, which isn't fantastic. But it was my first meet at 148. It was a little bit lower than what I had anticipated, but overall, I had a really good experience. Like there were, you know, I had a great day on Saturday seeing all the men compete. And then I had a fantastic day on Sunday seeing all the women compete. I mean, the women are outrageous, you know, yeah. And I was in a flight right after Susan Salazar. And I was like, this is phenomenal. Yeah. Like, this is so cool.
You know? That's how I felt.
Yeah. It's just like seeing all like the records being broken and like the ceilings just being busted through is just insane. The day started off kind of quiet, like for the women, I feel like in the beginning, it was kind of, everyone's still waking up, you know, people went out and celebrated after Saturday and whatnot. But I was a little worried in the beginning because I was like, oh, it's kind of quiet in here. Like, is the energy going to turn up? And then it eventually did. I think everyone's kind of quiet for the first flight of squats and then starts to get a little bit more animated.
Yeah.
But it was such a phenomenal experience that, yeah, I was disappointed that I went 5 for 9, but ultimately, I had a great time, and it was a big meet, and that's a big stage and a big platform to be on. It's an honor to be on the stage with so many world record holders, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so funny that you're telling me this right now, because I had the same experience with North America's. I haven't cut in years, and I just kind of go where I go, but I had had my cycle the week before, and I was at 150. And normally I sit at 140, but this year has been, my husband likes to cook, for anybody that's listening right now, follow his page. He is like, you Chef Boyardee, like he is amazing. And, you know, it just doesn't help for keeping the weight off.
Right.
So I started off on Sunday at 150. And so I thought, you know what, you know, I'm just going to water load a little bit. Well, towards the end of the week, it was like 152. 150. And I was like, I'll just water load a little bit. I've already been drinking a lot of water lately. We had a challenge at our gym, and I'll probably just get like 3 pounds. Like, because in the past, I haven't responded really well to water loading, not really well. It'll be maybe 4 pounds, you know? And I'm like, all right, that's good enough. So water loaded, started cutting back, took out some carbs, but kind of kept it there. After 2 days, I was 146.
And
I was like, And so I added a little bit more carbs in, but kept the water, you know, just followed its course. But I was like, let me just add a little bit more carbs in. And then it was like 145. And I was like, okay, I had to weigh in at night because I had to drive from early in the morning to Orange Beach. So it was 6 hours. So I just sipped. I ate some beef jerky. You know, it was minimal. By the time I got to weigh in, I was 143, almost 142 point. It was like there. I was like, what the hell is going on? And it's 4:30 p.m. the day before I compete. And I, you know, I had salt tabs, I had Pedialyte, I had everything I possibly could just in case. But I didn't feel bad the next day. I felt like I had, you know, I felt good. I also did not feel full though, like as you were talking. You know what I mean?
Just like, you don't, you feel like you don't have weight underneath the bar. Like, you know, you're just kind of existing, but without any authority.
That's a great way of putting it. It's like, I was there and it felt all right, but yeah, it did affect it. And, I finished with 270. I was supposed to hit 285 for my squat. I was supposed to hit 170 for my bench. I got the elusive third, of course. I got 160. And then I only hit my opener on deadlift, which was 320. I was supposed to finish at like 375.
So, twins.
Yeah. So, of course, I take my second attempt, and it was kind of a big hop. It was about 30 pounds, but I felt very confident with that. And it was like molasses, and then everything went like dark, and I never had that happen. So it was like, as I'm pulling, it goes dark, and then I just let go. And then I'm like, what the hell? So then I do it again. It happens again. And I'm like, the only thing that I think it could be was this. Because everything up until that point was going pretty well. You know, like training was going well. I was still progressing pretty well. My fatigue was good at that point. But yeah, and then I realized to myself, I was like, well, at this age, at this point in my life, I think I can water load pretty good. So if I have to do a water cut again, at least I know. And I was actually listening to the episode with you and Trevor on pass or fail, pass and fail, you know, and I think you two had brought up a good point that, you know, what is progress, right? Like, are you PRing every time? No. Yep. And that's okay, as long as you're making some sort of learning experience from what happened. And that's how I feel you know, for me, and it sounds like for you as well, like there was a learning experience to all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was my first time water loading and depleting and everything. So like I had no expectations and, you know, and you never know that it, like you mentioned, yours was totally different. Like in the past you had only gotten like 3 or 4 pounds or so. And this time you almost 10, and that's the same, you know, I had about like a 10 pound swing, and that's not going to happen every time, you know? Right. So I know that going forward, I can pretty comfortably probably train at about 156 or so. And then if I wanted to deplete and still keep my carbs in, I'm probably okay.
Yeah.
And you know, like water loading is, I feel like it's a hot topic on the internet right now, and it's not necessarily, there are some very strong stances either way, and it's not necessarily the smartest or safest, but when you're at the top of the sport, it is eventually going to be a weight class sport. You know, like there are people that are trying to break world records and they're going to be water cutting. So if you are doing a big meet and you're doing an invitational meet and, you know, it's a qualifying meet, there are, it is going to happen. So you just have to know how to do it the right way. And, Trevor and I always talk about, it's not necessarily how you get it off, it's what you put back on.
Right.
Like you can, everyone can deplete and everyone can lose the weight, but you can't replenish. If you don't replenish the right way, it doesn't matter. And right. That's kind of, it's, I miss out a little bit on the replenishment aspect. And I know that just from being at the meet all day. Like I drank water all day. I had my Pedialytes, like you mentioned, and Thermotabs and everything, but it just wasn't enough for that day. And that's okay. Right. I learned that for next time. So right. It's not a loss for me, you know?
Yeah.
I'll do better next time.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, same thing with me. Like I know as I was weighing in at 4 to 4:30, I was like, uh-oh, time wise. I was like, well, I've never done it this short. Let's see how this goes, you know? Yeah. And I actually don't ever cut. And the only reason why I did that was because I was so close. And if I didn't make it, I'd have to compete the next day. And I was already judging for the next days, and you know, they're counting on me to be there. And I was like, I can't do this. Like, I don't want to like wait one more day. I can't. The 148 was the max weight for that day. So I was like, oh, well, we gotta, you know, suck it up and do it. But, yeah, otherwise I kind of just walk in and wherever I'm at, you know, I just have, I'm not that competitive. I'm realistic about that. Like I'm strong, but I'm not competitively strong where I'll win my class anymore at that level. Like, I'm really there to have fun and set my own goals, but
absolutely,
for the most part, I'm not going to be that person that's, you know, that's going to win at these. They're very strong people at that level. So, I had a lot of fun and I did learn a lot. And, it's nice to hear somebody as like yourself, who's never, you know, at an elite level, has never water loaded, which is kind of crazy. I would have expected that you had done that by now, but
nope. First time experience on like one of the biggest platforms. I was like, well, if now is the time to do it, it is the time, I guess.
Is it both y'all look shredded too? I was like, dang, dude, like y'all were shredded. How did it feel?
Amazing. I kind of miss my abs. Right. I'm not gonna lie. You know, I laughed with Trevor. Like I have been an athlete my whole entire life. Like my uncles were pro AVP volleyball players, like they like sand volleyball players. So I started volleyball when I was like, you know, 6, like I was 8 years old, and they were putting ankle weights on me and telling me to jump in sand and like learn, you know. So I've been an athlete forever.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, Trevor, I've been an athlete my whole life and I have never had abs. And I was like, so this is like very liberating to me, you know, like obviously abs aren't an indication of strength or whatever, but it was something that I could be proud of. Cause I was like, I've always, you know, been very athletically inclined and this is cool.
Yeah.
You know? So I miss them a little bit, but you know, walking into Surge, we just walked in. Surge was 4 weeks after Showdown.
Right.
We mostly just did this meet just because we love those people and they always put on such a great meet. And I lived in that area and we have lots of friends in that area. And, so we were like, well, we'll just do this one for fun and walk in at whatever we weigh.
Yeah.
I walked in, I weighed in at 154. So I was up, you know, like 9 pounds and I felt normal. Like I'd been eating like normal, no depletion or anything. And I had a better day. I still didn't go 9 for 9, but I feel like if you go 9 for 9, sometimes it's disappointing because you feel like you didn't try.
Yeah.
You know,
I feel like a lot of people, and I find more, I don't know, maybe it's like more of a trend now too, you know, like, oh, everybody always wants to go 9 for 9. And I'm like, yeah, but are you playing it too safe? Like you want to be successful.
Right. Did you leave? Like how many pounds did you leave on the platform that you could have, you know, and what do you really lose trying, right?
Right.
So I, on my third attempt deadlift, we were deciding between two numbers and Trevor was like, well, this lighter number, he's like, it's pretty much a guarantee that you'll get it. And my goal for this one, for that, for surge was I wanted to hit the 500 dots. I ended up walking away with like 490 and some change. So I was really close.
Yeah.
But, even if I had hit my third deadlift, like the lower end or the higher end, it still wouldn't have gotten me the, like if I had chosen the safer route that the guaranteed third attempt deadlift, it still wouldn't have gotten me the 500 dots. So the stretch of, okay, the second one is heavier. It's like a 50-50 chance. And if you'll get it, but this is what will get it for you. And I'm like, well, may as well send it. Like if I miss, you know, like either way, it doesn't matter either. If I don't hit this either way, I'm not getting the 500 dots. So we went with the heavier one and it was a little, just like 6 pounds too heavy. Like the one jump down from that, I probably would have secured it. But, like sometimes you have to go for it.
Yeah.
You know, not be so concerned about having your perfect day. Like everyone gets like a perfect unicorn day at some point. But sometimes you have to push that boundary or else you don't even know what you're capable of. Because what if I would have pulled that? That would have been more than I expected to. And I would have surprised myself.
Yeah.
So I don't love the 9 for 9 trend. I think, you know, for a first meet, that's generally what lifters want to do because they want to be confident. They want to get something on the board and everything. But past that, if your only goal is to go 9 for 9, I don't think you're pushing yourself to your truest potential.
I completely agree. Yeah. I always laugh when like I'll have people that, you know, I only hit this and I really wanted to hit this. And I'm like, well, you should have just went for it. Like you knew what you did. You should have just went for it. And that I used to be very afraid in the beginning. My husband is, and I don't know if this is a male trait, but he'd be like, go big, Heidi, always go big. You know, like he is like, he's a person that's like, he's not a handler at all. My husband is not a powerlifter. Like he powerlifted years ago when we both first started, but he doesn't really enjoy powerlifting. It's hard on his body. So, but he lifts, you know, he trains. But he is always a person that's like, meh, and let's do that one. Okay, let's do that. Like he's always like, what did you do
it
before?
Must be
he's
it
like,
must be a male thing.
Does Trevor like that?
After, you know, his rationale to me was, he's like, well, you can either play it safe or you can send it. And I'm like, well, I guess I'll send it.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I mean, play it safe doesn't sound fun.
No. Yeah.
You sound like a wuss. Safe,
all right. Don't call me a baby. I am strong. I can do this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But so tell me a little bit, like, how did you even get into powerlifting? Because if you did volleyball most of your life, did you play any other sports that led you into powerlifting?
Not really. So volleyball was the main sport. Like I started very, very young. My uncle was a coach for like a club volleyball team, like outside of school, you know, like a travel team. So he started me pretty young and I started doing like traveling volleyball teams and meets and everything very, very young. And I played in middle school and then in high school, I didn't love the coaching. So I stayed outside of high school volleyball organizational teams and just played the club sport. So that way I was traveling like different states pretty much every weekend or every other weekend to play tournaments and such. So I played volleyball for about 14 years. Wow. And when I wasn't playing volleyball, I ran track just to keep like the conditioning because their times were opposite for me. So I was a sprinter in track. Like I ran the 400 and the 200 and I did high jump. I played basketball for a few years, but that wasn't my forte and it kind of overlapped with volleyball. So it interfered a bit. And then after high school, I didn't really play any sports. At the end of high school, I started to fall in with like pretty bad crowds and got myself into some trouble. So I didn't quite play any sports. That wasn't my main focus. You know, my main focus was being cool and hanging out with friends and parties. So
typical kind of our age at that at that time, right?
Absolutely. I look back and I'm like, God, damn it. Idiot. I fell off the wagon with that stuff for a few years. And then I was in a relationship in college with a guy who was interested in bodybuilding. And so I started going to the gym with him. I had no idea really what I was doing. Like I'd been in a weight room for volleyball and stuff, but you pretty much only do like leg extensions, leg curls. You don't, you know, like box squats. You don't have to like full normal range of motion squats like we do now. So I had been in gyms like a lot, but it just, the training was so different. But I like a challenge. So I would go to the gym with him and would do like his bodybuilding workouts and whatnot. And then I was like, this is really kind of fun. Like I like, it's a new way to push myself. It's kind of, it reignited a flame of competitor in me that I had had from playing organized sports to where I was like, you know, I'm really interested in this. And I got like so interested and I found like women like Dana Lynn Bailey, and people like that, that were in bodybuilding. And I was like, this is really cool. I have fun time with this. And I did that for a couple of years. And then I realized that being strong was a lot more fun. Like I had people, I was living in North Carolina at the time. And I had people tell me like, hey, you're pretty strong. Like you probably be pretty good at powerlifting. And I was like, I don't know anything about that. And you know, the person I was in a relationship with didn't know anything about it either. So I was like, I wouldn't know where to start.
Right.
And then I kind of realized that like being strong was more fun or more important to me than looking aesthetically a certain way. Mm. Like, yes, I mentioned earlier, I liked having my abs, like that was really cool and whatnot, but it wasn't important. Like it wasn't a priority. Like being strong was really cool. Like I would see, just from following like Dana Lynn Bailey, I would see other women that were powerlifting because she kind of networked outside of her sport and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is really cool. Like, I think I'm going to try this. And I think the first program that I ran was like a juggernaut program, like a 12-week, whatever. And it was kind of like a cross between bodybuilding and powerlifting. Like I got to lift heavy, but then got to do my accessories, high reps afterwards and get a pump and whatever. So that was really cool. And then I was like, this is pretty fun. So I hired my first coach and it kind of went from there. That was, I think I started officially in 2017 powerlifting. So I don't know how many years that is. 4 years.
Yeah.
Almost 5 years. Yeah. So
that's crazy. Okay. So then you took off and then, so from powerlifting, so then you, when did you decide to be a coach?
It's going on 3 years now. Like I think this January or February is 3 years. Once I started competing, I realized that I really, really, really liked the aspect of helping people in the process of getting stronger. Yeah. So, it more started when I moved to Chicago and I was lifting at Surge to New Levels. And I was lifting at Rockwell. I was surrounded by people that were always really, really encouraging, like Sergio Luna from Surge to New Levels. You know, he had a bunch of girls that he coached in person and I really, really enjoyed watching him coach them, like giving them real time feedback. And I would pick up on the things that like he would say.
Yeah.
And my coach at the time, like he would, whenever I would send him videos, he would give me feedback and be like, oh, I see that. So I felt like, I was like, I'm seeing these things in these movements that are a little bit more analytical. And then I would go to Rockwell and I would see other people at Rockwell. Like they have a bunch of awesome trainers there too. And I would watch their stuff and see what they had to say about movements. And I was like, I really enjoy this aspect of like finding the small tweaks and fixing them and like kind of like taking off the parking brake on people's lifts and seeing the light bulb and everything. So after I started competing, I talked to my coach about like wanting to coach and he was like, okay, we can start that. Like I'll mentor you. And he gave me a couple clients, you know, that had came to him and he was like, hey, how would you feel about, you know, my quote unquote protege coaching you, you know?
Yeah.
And so a couple people said yes. And my first client actually lives in Florida. Her name's Nikki. And she was the first person that I coached. And it was so fun. And I had such a good experience with that. And I was like, I really, really enjoy this. So I started putting out, you know, like sharing Nikki's progress. And I had another guy named Cole and I was sharing his progress too. And then it started to kind of snowball from there. Me just consistently sharing like the progress that they made, and sharing like how I can help, you know, even if it wasn't necessarily just in like Trevor's really great at putting out content with movement, but I'm really, my focus a lot is the like mental aspect of it as far as like getting more confident with your strength, believing in yourself and everything. So putting out that content really, really helped to grow because people would catch on and they say, oh, this person can help me. Yeah. And that's ultimately like what a coach does, right? That's what their job is to showcase how they can help people in many different ways. And I went to school to study psychology and I love communication. So the mental aspect of it comes really, really naturally to me.
Right.
I don't think that you can have a good coach relationship if you can't communicate with your coach or if the coach can't communicate with the lifter.
Right.
So not everyone's a good fit for everyone, but you try to cater to people as you as you see fit. So I would just continue to put up more information, and the community kind of kept growing because all of the people that I worked, that I was coaching, would talk to each other, and it felt like a team. And, you know, I had my hashtag like habitual strength. And so anyone who was on the team, they would hashtag that, and then they would find other teammates and they would comment on each other's things. And, you know, if I saw an athlete, I'd be like, oh, so-and-so did this last week. And I would kind of try to bring them together because that's what it is. It's a team, it's a community. So it kind of just kept snowballing from there, and it really picked up steam kind of after all the COVID stuff happened. And during COVID there, unfortunately, I was contacted by quite a few people that said, hey, my coach doesn't know how to help me if I don't have a gym. Can you help me? And that was really disheartening to hear, because as a coach, you know, you expect other coaches to be adaptable and help people.
Right.
And there were lifters that were like, I don't have access to a gym, but I have a kettlebell, a dumbbell, a band.
It's always those three things. Like, it's always like
everyone has a jump rope, and I don't know, no power lifters do cardio. Why do all of you people have jump ropes?
I would laugh at the same thing. And that is like a 20-pound kettlebell and like maybe like a 15-pound one, but I only have one dumbbell. Yes. Like, right, like, okay, we'll work on that.
Every time. Yes, every time. And that was when it really picked up steam, because I was like, okay, you have these three really non-related items that we can do something with, but we'll figure it out, you know? And were those programs like actually helping people get stronger during their shutdowns? Like, no, but it kept people moving and they weren't going crazy being stuck in their house for almost a year. Yeah. So that was when I saw the biggest increase, is because, you know, everyone was happy that I was willing to help. And there were some other great coaches, you know, like I saw a lot of other great coaches that were like, we'll do it. We'll be adaptable, be like water, figure out whatever we can do with your equipment, and we'll go from there. And that, I feel like that was awesome. Like, that was so cool to see the community come together in that aspect and be like, we'll figure it out together.
Yeah. I think so it's important that like, not only as a coach, but that is, you know, like your business, right? Like, are you able to adapt when things change? And this is probably, nobody expected something like this.
No.
Right. And people were seeking a community during this time because they were so separated from any kind of community that they knew. So, I mean, doing something like that just brings everybody together. And yeah, it's like getting them moving. Like, we did Zoom because we own a gym, right? Yeah. So we did all these Zoom. My husband hated it. He's like, I'm doing it because we need to do something. We keep them together. But he's like, I could never do this real life. Like, I could never. Like, he's like, I have to look at this little screen. And I'm like, wait. And then, you know, like, click on the person. Like, no, bring your hips up higher. Okay. And then he's like, it's so hard to, like, have a bunch of people in one time. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, we're really trying to just still service the people that we have in the best way that we possibly can, and to keep them going.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's not, they weren't necessarily probably getting any stronger doing one, you know, six kettlebell movements back to back, but you didn't feel so bad because you were doing something,
right?
You know, because some people, like, we're very fortunate that we have a garage gym,
right?
You know, we have equipment so we could keep training, but that's not realistic for everyone. And you really, really saw who was dedicated to it, because they would go on Facebook Marketplace and wherever and be like, okay, I have a barbell.
Yeah.
You know, I have weight plates. I have, you know, I have one pair of 45s and I have a 25. Like, what can we do with that? They're like, I have a lot of clients who lived in apartments and they were like, okay, I'm on the second story, so I can't really deadlift, but I can squat and I can do floor press because I don't have a bench. And so we just figured out ways to do it. But you really, really saw who was dedicated to, you know, getting better and improving by those who took the extra step to purchase stuff that they found, even if it was a rusted out old barbell. Who cares? You had something.
Yeah.
You know,
I had a friend that, I don't know if you know who Sin is, Sin Leung. Well, anyway, she lives in New York. and her brother made a wood squat rack.
I saw that so often. That's so cool.
I was like, dude, that's crazy. Like, that's not even her field. Like, she's a graphic designer. She manages, like, Estee Lauder's graphic. I mean, she does, like, that kind of stuff. I'm like, yo, I can't believe you just made, like, a wood squat rack. Like, that is amazing. Yeah. Like, that's initiative.
It's definitely not safe because yeah. I definitely had a client that like they would go to racket and they would send videos and it would like smooth back and forth. And I'm like, oh my gosh, please don't die trying to re-rack this weight. But yeah, like I saw that so often where they would put like the, you know, 2x4s in like a thing of cement, or they would figure out ways to fasten it. And I'm like, that's dedication. You know, that's really cool to see.
Yeah, totally.
I love that.
Well, I wanted to get into some of these questions that we had. So I had posted a Q&A on our page. And so if anybody ever sees the golden mic that we have, we're going to ask our coaches or our guests some questions. And we had a bunch of great questions. And we're going to ask about 5 or 6 right now. So let's go over the first one. And this one is from – and so I just met this girl – when did I meet her? At a meet a few months ago. And she is from, like, our area. And she's young. She's 16, she's probably going to be like, oh my gosh, I'm younger than that. I know she's in high school. She's young. But she asked, how did you become a coach and what process did you take to grow your community? So I guess we kind of covered a majority of growing your community. How about now? Like, how is it that you're growing your community? And when you did become a coach, did you get certified? Did you do anything? I think a lot of people who start off training think like, oh, I got to get a certification. I got to do this, and this. But that might not always be the case or the journey that you might have had. So what was kind of those steps in that way for you in the professional side?
Sure. So I go back and forth. I actually just had this conversation with Trevor like a week ago about certifications. I go back and forth all the time on if I find it important or not. Personally, I don't have those certifications. And it's not bad if you do, and it's not bad if you don't, in my opinion. I look at it as a lot of those certifications teach you how to understand information really well and teach you how to read information really well. Sometimes I think that what they are lacking, and this is sometimes because there are some great certifications, sometimes it doesn't teach you the application very well. Yeah. And I find experience to always be the number one thing when it comes to coaching, because yes, you can pick up a book and you can open it and you can look at the little anatomical chart that they show you and see how that person squats. But unless you have, you know, 20 identical clones to that person, they're not going to squat the same or bench or deadlift. So it is great for knowing information to get those certifications, because it does teach you a lot of things that you should know, like where your muscle inserts are, why this would be causing this, X, all this information. That's great. But I think that a lot of what it is lacking is the practical application. If you cannot look at an athlete and see, okay, I see that this is breaking down here, this is how we fix it, you're not going to be as successful as you could be.
Yeah.
So I see a lot of really, really great trainers online who have 4, 5, and 6 different certifications, but they're struggling to get clients because maybe they can't apply it in that way, or they don't know how to communicate to the athlete to make them understand the concepts that they're trying to teach them. So I go back and forth on if I think that's important or not. If you want to get a certification, by all means, get a certification, but also make sure that you are getting just as much time with in-person experience. Ask questions. Like if you are at a gym that you have a lot of coaches and trainers, ask them questions. Ask them to break down your lifts, or look at, you know, get a friend and ask your friend if you can break down their lifts and see what they could be doing better at. But I think that the experience part is way more important. So personally, I do not have any certifications. I read a lot. I am one of those people to where I ask a lot of questions. I probably ask Trevor more questions than anyone in the world, and he answers them diligently every time, no matter how dumb. So that's great for me. I am very lucky that I have him in-house to learn from. I read a lot of books. If I want to learn something, I figure out a way to learn it and I figure out how to apply it. We have stacks and stacks. We have a full bookshelf full of different types of programming, different anatomy books, everything. Like I'm currently reading a book that I just started today called Built from Broken. And it just teaches you like science of pain and like where, like how you can avoid those things or how you can come back. And it's not necessarily that I think that that book is the end all be all, or the next book I read is the end all be all to all my information. But I like to take all this information in and be a filter for it, right? Yeah. They always say be a sponge, but being a sponge is absorbing everything and trying to apply everything at once. And sometimes you have to be more of a filter and kind of figure out what is important and how to apply it. Because not everything is going to be important or applicable. You know, not everything is going to work for lifter A as it does for lifter B. Right. So being a filter and kind of figuring out where you can apply these things is really, really important. So that was my long story short certifications. So I personally don't have any certifications, but I'm always seeking out knowledge from other coaches that are more experienced than me. A lot of the times when we go to meets, I get a chance to sit down with other high level coaches and talk about things. You know, like we had breakfast at Surge, we had breakfast with like Joe Corsi and Chris Bridgeford. So I get to ask, we get to all talk. And kind of, you know, say like, oh, this is working for someone and this isn't working for someone and vice versa. So I get to have lots of conversations. I'm very fortunate that I get to have lots of conversations with high level coaches that are doing really, really well. And I feel like that's how I learn best. So for someone else, if you want to seek out those certifications, absolutely do that. It's all knowledge. It's all going to help you. But just know that, in my opinion, I think experience is the most important aspect of that. So in continuing to grow my community, that's what I do. Seek out new information from different coaches that are doing things differently than I am. I will always ask questions. And even in growing my community now, like I have a roster of like 70 plus athletes right now. And it keeps growing because I'm showing that I can help people.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm showing that, like, you met Kelly and Kelly mentioned that, you know, I've helped her kind of come out of her shell a little bit. And those things are just as important as strength gains, because if you don't actually believe in yourself to get stronger, you'll never get stronger. So being able to show that I can help people, you know, kind of come out of their shell a little bit is how it keeps growing. And I keep meeting more people and talking to more people and I get referrals and all that. So it's a lot simpler, I think, than people make it seem, but the small things are really, really important in growing your own business.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that, like, a lot of times when I run into people who are looking to become a trainer or a coach, their initial, I think, hang up is validation. Like, I want to feel like people can trust me, or like I'm able to be validated quickly. And a certification almost does that. It's like, oh yeah, I am certified in ASIM or whatever it may be. But yeah, I mean, I've been certified in, I don't know how many of those, you know, personal trainer ones. And they were all very general. And really, they sort of just checked the box of what I needed when I was working in a regular gym. Like, hey, we need you to be certified and you have insurance. Yep. So if you do plan on going to work at a gym, that might be something that they have. Like, they are like, okay, you got to be certified in this in order to do that. But I completely agree. I think we sometimes are so afraid of that next step. Like, okay, well now what, you know, like, what do I do next? It's experience. And you got to be an open book and willing to ask questions and, leverage you're leveraging these other coaches, you know, and, it's these opportunities where you get to go and eat. Like, a lot of the things I do because it's the opportunity to be around people like you and Trevor, you know, and these higher level people that have more knowledge and experience than I do. And that I can leverage their knowledge and what they know and how they work with people, watch how they're training people in person. And that has helped me grow to where I am. And that's definitely it. So, like, putting yourself out there and just, I think it, like, exactly what you said, like, you taught and you learned at the same time. Like, you started coaching, but it was really like it, within the first year, like, you know what? I think I could do this and still learn to be stronger at the same time.
Yeah, you can absolutely do both, and you can learn something from everyone that you meet. Like, there is not, you could be at the highest level and there's still something that you could learn from someone who's just starting out. Because when you're someone who has learned, like, forgotten more than they actually think they know, you know, if you've been coaching for 10 plus years, you forgot what you did year one. And then so you're reminded by someone who's just starting about, oh, I kind of overlooked that detail. So I find myself learning from someone all the time. And, you know, going to meets, even if I'm not competing, going to meets is a great way for me to, like, people call it like networking. Yeah. It's just creating a connection, you know, like you're meeting new people, you're creating a connection. Like, you don't know what that person has to offer or what this next person has to offer. So even if they aren't a coach, like, if you are wanting to build your coaching business, it would behoove you to go to these meets and meet new people, because that's how you get referrals. And the best way to grow an online coaching business, in my opinion, is word of mouth. Like, if people don't know who you are or people aren't talking about you, you're probably not going to continue to grow. You will grow within your small community of like people that are probably local to you. But when you, if you want to expand and just do everything online and have, you know, athletes all across the country and the world, you have to meet new people. So it is, like you said, putting yourself out there, just kind of doing it, you know, it can be hard. I'm a little introverted. So it's a little exhausting and challenging going to meets all weekend because I had to recharge my batteries for a few days after being at meets all weekend. So you have to kind of get a little uncomfortable. You have to get comfortable being a little uncomfortable at those meets and just being like, hey, I'm Riley. I really like this, or I really like this content that you put out, or, you know, hey, could you show me why you just did that thing or why you just said whatever, like be okay with asking questions. Like if someone doesn't help you, that's okay. You tried, you asked and whatever, just move on to someone else. But you have to put yourself out there. Absolutely.
That's so true. I mean, my husband's an introvert and I have a feeling that Trevor's not really an introvert and I'm not really an introvert. So I can see how opposites, right?
Trevor is actually very much, we're both very much introverts.
Oh, no
way. We are both very, like socially, like out, we are very like extroverted. Like we'll talk to whoever, but we come back and we're like, okay, we're just going to stay in our little home and just go to the grocery store and lift in our garage. And then we have enough energy for the next weekend.
That's so funny. Yeah, totally. So you guys really recharge Monday through Friday.
Yes.
Yeah. My husband's the same ways. And I think that when we opened the gym, there were many times that we went to events and it stretches him. Even to this day, when we go out and we do things, he knows that it's good that he does that and he puts himself out there. But yeah, it doesn't come easy to him to just be like, hey, what's going on? He doesn't make small talk like that, you know? So he's had to learn how to be better at that and let go of some of maybe the preconceived notions of himself as he, you know, asks these questions. But then he also has to recharge after. He's like, I need like video games.
A few days.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to your next one. So this is a great one. This one's from Kelly, the woman we were talking about earlier. Woohoo, Kelly, she did great. We competed together. What is the mindset for moving on after a bad meet?
This one's tough because everyone's going to have a bad meet or multiple bad meets in their career, especially if you are competing for a long time. It is hard to say that you just move on from it because like, yeah, that of course that's what you're supposed to do, but that's way easier said than done. You know, like after Showdown, I was pretty disappointed because I was like, I reflected doing much better than this in training. Yeah. And there's always different aspects that go into it. And your life is a big impact on your training, whether or not people want to admit it or not. Like the stress that you go through in day-to-day life outside of training is a big impact. And like this last year for everyone, even with all the shutdowns and, you know, everything that's going on with like quarantines and things like that, that is a massive life change that people are probably still adapting to.
Yeah.
And then plus we have all of our normal life stressors on top of it. So it has been a year of weirdness, I feel like, for most people. And it seems like everyone is kind of struggling to get back into the competition kind of mode. Like I know there were a lot of people at Showdown, there were a lot of great performances, and then there were a lot of people that were like, oh, I didn't really do as great as I thought I would either. Like I reflected back on the Showdown afterwards and I was like, yeah, a lot of people didn't have like their best day. Like I wonder why that is. And of course, like life factors are different for everyone. But generally what I say is, you know, allow yourself that time to be disappointed. I always say 5 minutes. I'm like, allow yourself 5 minutes to be disappointed in your performance. But ultimately, like feeling disappointed and feeling bad about yourself does nothing for your progress going forward. That's why I say 5 minutes, like cap it there. You know, for 5 minutes, you can wallow in your self-pity of whatever you think. But after 5 minutes, you got to move forward from it. And like I said, it's easier said than done. But for most people that have a bad meet, it is not your last one. Right. And it probably isn't even your second to last or your third to last. It's probably somewhere in the middle, ultimately, of your career of competitions that you do. And by the time you get to your last meet, I guarantee you, you won't even remember that bad beat.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get out of that mindset of like living in the moment of being like, wow, this is really, really, really important right now, but it probably won't be important a year from now, you know, between that bad meet and your next meet, there are so many things that are going to happen, and you have to set yourself up for success for that next meet. So if you're constantly thinking about how poorly you did last week, last month, 3 months ago, you're only kind of, what do people say? You're like manifesting that for your next meet, yeah. Right? So if you're constantly thinking about how poorly you did at the last one, you're already kind of setting yourself up for that mindset for the next one. So give yourself the 5 minutes, just be like, that was terrible. I'm disappointed. I should have done better. You have to give yourself that time. Like you have to, or else you'll just kind of suppress it, and suppressing emotions generally does no good for anyone.
Yeah.
So give yourself that little bit of time and then remind yourself, okay, that was doing nothing for me to progress. That did nothing for me to progress forward. So now from here on out, I make a plan. I figure out what I needed to change. And sometimes that is, you know, attacking programming a different way. Sometimes that is being better with your nutrition. Sometimes that is being better with your food or your sleep. Sometimes that is a better mindset shift. But there are multiple different facets that go into training and performance, and it's not just the program. So it's being realistic and being honest with yourself about what you needed to do in order to execute better. A lot of people talk about being positive, and they're like, oh yeah, I'm really, really optimistic and I'm really, really positive and I feel good. But then the first thing that they do after a training session is say something negative. I'm like, well, you're being positive right now, yes, but the other 99% of the time, the first thing that you have to say is negative about your training. Right. So there's been a couple of lifters who, if they send me their videos, I make it a rule. I'm like, okay, once you send me your training videos, before you can tell me what you didn't like about it, you have to tell me two things that you liked about your training session.
That's a psychologist in you. And that's so spot on, right? You're already setting the tone. Like, you already know that they're going to say something negative about what they do.
Yep. There have been not a lot. There have been a handful of lifters that I've done that for, because it's like, every text was like, oh, these move like trash, yeah, or oh, I hated this, whatever. And I'm like, you have to tell me one or two good things before you can tell me a bad thing, because that's how you rework your brain, right? Because totally. If you're so used to automatically going to that negative place, you have to rewire it to go to the positive first. So, and that takes time. That's not going to be just a week, you know, that can be months or years.
Yeah.
So that's generally what I ask. Tell me something good. Make a plan.
Yeah.
You know, so if you had a bad meet, make a plan for the next one. Be like, okay, this is the timeline I want for my next meet.
Yeah.
Here are the numbers that I want to aim for, and here's how I'm going to do it. I actually made on our plane ride back home from Chicago, I made a list of non-negotiables that I'm going to do for myself going forward. And they're very simple so far. I only have three so far. A gallon of water a day, because that's where I lack, is my hydration. 20 minutes of reading a day, because I don't always get that reading time in, and I love that learning aspect. Mm-hmm. And then also 15 minutes of non-training related movement a day. So that could be a yoga flow. That could be me getting on the floor and doing bird dogs, whatever. But those are my non-negotiables. So after a meet that you had that you did poorly at, set yourself up with some non-negotiables. Like, okay, this meet prep, I didn't sleep very well. So my non-negotiables are going to be, I'm going to aim for 7 hours of sleep a night, or yeah, whatever it is, you know, but set those up for yourself. But you have to be accountable for your progress going forward. So I think that action alleviates anxiety. Like, yeah, I think that that's very, very true.
Yep.
So creating a plan for what you can do for the next meet helps you kind of get past that little speed bump of a bad meet.
Yeah. And this is interesting how you talk about, people's mindset with their training, because I have an athlete who she go 8 for 9 that weekend. And you know, she had when she benched, the bar was bouncing off her chest. Mm-hmm. So it just wasn't staying steady, you know, so it was the longest pause, right? So they're waiting for it to, yes, stop, and then they press. And of course she missed it. She was pissed, like super pissed. She has a very high standard of competitiveness for herself. She's a competitive gymnast, cheer.
Wow.
Yeah. And so this, you know, she's really just an overall strong person. But with her, it's the same thing. She at the end of the day, she pulled like 364. And, you know, like our overshoot was 370-ish. And just because I wanted to, you know, be safe, and I was like, all right, I think you could pull this. Maybe you could pull the 370. I'd rather you have a you know, let's get all three. She was pissed off about her bench. And she did great. She had a 30-pound PR for total PR. And but kept thinking about the negatives, right? Like, yeah. God, I should have had that bench. I should have just went more for this. And, you know, it was so much. And then she realized it. She was like, I need to stop thinking about the bad. And I said, dude, you had a 30-pound total PR. Like, how many people have that between, like, 4 months of training, 5 months of training? Yep. It doesn't happen. I go, it's an amazing.
People fight tooth and nail for 5 pounds all the time.
Yes. And I'm like, do you understand I had a 50-pound loss?
Right.
Like, do you see what I'm telling you right now? She's like, I know. I go, and I love the competitive spirit and always wanting to do better, right? You see the potential in yourself. You know what you can do, but you also have to be okay with living in the moment and feeling happy for what you have. And I saw a lot of myself in her when I first started training, when I first started bodybuilding, because I could never be lean enough, or I could never be, you know, shoulders weren't big enough, or, you know, and you're always sort of picking these things about yourself versus saying, hey, that was a good training session, or I lifted what I needed to. Not like, oh, the bar just moved really slow, or, you know, I think there's a time and a place for that, but it is a balancing act, and you can't separate the mental from the physical. I mean, nope. I think if you think you can do that, you're totally wrong. That's no sport whatsoever. I think those are all great, great points moving into kind of getting over like a really bad meet. All right. So let's move on to the next. This is so good. I'm so happy about this. Okay. So at what point in your powerlifting journey did you see a huge leap in strength gains, and what do you attribute it to? And this is from Hannah3405.
So I like this question because I actually have like an opposite answer from what most people have is, you know, most people are like, oh, the first like 2 years I had the most strength gains because newbie gains and whatever. And, you know, then it starts to slow down. So I came into this, and I don't even mean to sound like braggadocious about this, but I came into this sport like pretty strong already for like being a newbie. Like I'm pretty sure like I squatted 315, I pulled 365, and I want to say I benched like 185, like coming into powerlifting. And obviously my numbers have grown since then, but I've also been powerlifting for almost 5 years now. And that starting point to where I'm at now isn't massively different. Like that's, you know, 315 to my best squat in comp. My most recent squat in comp was 374. So realistically, if you look about that across 5 years, that is, 50 pounds, 60 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, so that's not anything egregious. Like there are some people who add 100+ pounds to their lifts in the first couple of years. I came into the sport relatively strong from having all of that athletic background. Like I already had a foundation and a base of strength and muscle. So coming into it, like I remember running that juggernaut program, and when I tested my maxes, I was like, cool, I'm pretty close to pulling 400 already. Like, you know, awesome. Like that's, yeah, that's so cool. But it is kind of difficult for me because I do feel like I am one of those people who are fighting tooth and nail to like add a little bit more to each lift all the time. Yeah. So I feel like I understood the process of how long it takes to get stronger from earlier on compared to most people. Yeah. There are people that are still, you know, 2 to 3 years into their powerlifting journey, and they're asking why they're not hitting their lifetime strongest PR goals. And I'm like, you're only 2 years in, you have a long way to go. Yeah. You know, like unless they only want to powerlift for like definitively like, okay, I only want to powerlift for 5 years, so I have to hit my ultimate goal in 5 years. There's not that many people that say that though. You know, most people want to powerlift for as long as they possibly can. So for me, I learned that thought process of, okay, this takes a lot of time and a lot of patience. And I'm a very patient person. So that works out really, really well for me that I am okay with the fact that I'm not hitting 20 to 30 pound PRs on each lift every single time that I go to a meet. You know, like I'm either I've been hitting the same or increasing by five or hitting less sometimes, you know, at showdown. So I had to learn that really, really quickly. But I think that for most people, they generally see the most strength gains in like years 2 and 3. Cause like one, you're kind of building that foundation. 2 to 3 is where you're seeing like the most, you're hitting your peak of your newbie gains. Mm-hmm. And then it seems like that 4 and 5 years when it starts to trickle down a little bit, you know, there are outliers always that are going to be able to increase their squat, bench and deadlift by 10, 15, 20 pounds every time they compete. But those are outliers. Right. You know, that is the 2% of the powerlifting community that most of us aren't. So it is really, really important that people do understand that this is a long game. I actually had a conversation with Charlie Binkley last weekend when Trevor was competing. And, you know, Charlie was like, Trevor is 42 and is still hitting deadlift PRs. He deadlifted 810. And his previous, last year, he pulled 804. So it took him a year to add 6 pounds to his deadlift.
Right.
And, you know, he's done 30 plus competitions and it still took him 1 year to add 6 pounds to his deadlift. And in between that time, he went backwards. He went a little bit forwards. He went backwards again. And then finally pulled a 6 pound PR. So it should be eye opening to people that at some point it is going to take a lot of time to add 5 pounds on your lifts. So definitely be really, really excited if you're still in that phase of like, oh, I PR'd my total by 50, 60 pounds, or I PR'd each lift by 10 pounds, 20 pounds. You know, you'd definitely be super, super excited about that. But realize that at some point it does start to slow down. And that's when you have to stack up your progress in different ways. You know, like technique wins, mindset wins, rep PRs, I think are really, really important too when you get to a certain training age. So, you have to love the process. You have to be okay with the process being a little bit slow because that does wear off. The newbie gains go away.
Yeah. And I think, you know, exactly what you're saying. I think the biggest takeaway is that you didn't really have like a huge leap in strength gains is what she's kind of alluding to. Like it is a process that since you did come in, you know, fairly strong already, that you're already there, right? So you're probably not going to have like a ton of like, wow. And I think that that's something just to remember that I would say that I'm trying to think besides my athlete that recently, I don't think I've really had anybody that had huge leaps in a training block of some sort, you know, like did they have progress? Yes, of course. But I would never say like, oh, this person added 200 pounds like that really, I just don't see that happening. And so also like, what is a leap to you? Is a leap 20 pounds? Is it 50 pounds, or is it like a leap for me would be 10 pounds. If I got 10 pounds on my bench, like
I would shoot same.
I mean, and I think of a year, like if I had just 2 training blocks, you know, like in a whole year, fuck, that'd be great. I'd be so happy. So yeah, I mean, and I've never personally had like huge leaps either. I think the biggest leap I had was actually getting a coach, and it was with Susan. Susan was my first coach. Okay. And I ran conjugate for the first time. And so that was different. It was a different stimulation. I had just had my last child. So my weight was coming down. There was a lot of things happening at one time. And so I got lighter and I got stronger. And that, for me, that was like a huge leap, but I had a real good structure. I had a lot more technique benefits, you know, training with Susan, that I was just, you know, I was coaching myself prior to that. And to me personally, that's where I found like I was able to kind of really take off. But even then, it wasn't like I added 50 pounds on my total. Like,
right.
You know, it was still minuscule, but it was better. It was, you know, it wasn't huge.
It's still progress.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Okay, so moving on. What is one of the most helpful things to improve sumo deadlifts? And this is also from Hollister_lifts.
So sumo is so much more finesse than conventional. Sumo is one of those things that you kind of have to practice all the time, right? And it is mostly patience. And when I first started powerlifting, I was a conventional puller. And as I've gotten smaller, I've switched to sumo because my leverage has changed and sumo is what's stronger for me right now. Yeah. And with sumo, I had to learn to be a little bit more controlled and patient. It is not a grip and rip. You can't just bend over and pick it up like you can at conventional. It requires so much more finesse and it is so technical. And so I always laugh when I see people on the internet that's like, sumo is cheating. And I'm like, that's because you can't sumo. Yes.
Like, tell me you don't sumo without telling me you don't sumo. You know, it's like,
exactly. So the best thing whenever I have an athlete who wants to switch to sumo, the thing that I have them do is actually start from blocks. Shorten your range of motion, you know, like nothing super, super tall. Like I usually have them start from like a 2-inch block. So that way they can find their position and then they can just focus on one aspect of the lift at a time. So with the 2-inch block with sumo, you're really only focusing on pretty much the lockout at that point. Like you've taken out the hard aspect of it off the floor. So you can figure out that part of the lift. And then once they get through that training cycle, I'll drop it to a 1-inch block. Yeah. So that way they get a little bit more range of motion and I drop it to the floor because it is, when you pull from the floor, it is a lot harder. Like generally most people from sumo, they have to have all the patience off the floor as possible. I luckily have the opposite problem. I'm very fast off the floor and I'm very slow at lockout. I have very internally rotated shoulders. So my chest likes to stay down and I can't pull it up, but I like to take that progress for people learning is to slowly guide them down to the floor because that's the best way to feel your position or what you should be feeling at each point of the lift. So when you're 2 inches up, you feel what you should be feeling towards the lockout. 1 inch up, you feel where you should be in the middle of the lift. And then from the floor, you can kind of put it all together.
Yeah.
So I find that to be super, super beneficial, but you do have to practice sumo a lot. So for sumo pullers, if I'm not doing that progression for them, I will teach them how to sumo in different ways. So I will maybe take their RDL to a sumo position. Mm-hmm. So instead of doing a standard conventional RDL, they'll do a sumo RDL because they have to control the weight down, stop it shy of the floor. So they have to have the control and they can feel that position, that eccentric position on where they should be and how their torso should be tall. So other than just practice, you have to find movements that mimic the sumo. So sumo RDLs, block pulls, I think are very, very beneficial. I do like snatch grip for sumo because it does teach lifters to pull their chest up and through, mm-hmm. which most people, that's where they struggle is everything, their upper back rounds and they can't pull through to the lockout.
Yep.
So frequency is your friend with sumo, doing it two, potentially a third time with variation throughout the week, as long as you can handle that sort of frequency, mm-hmm. I think is really, really beneficial for growing sumo, but also be patient, be very, very patient off the floor.
Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest ones that, that most people who switch from conventional to sumo also have a difficult time transitioning because they're so used to it popping off the floor, that they try to mimic that. But that's one of the, probably the biggest thing I've changed since I trained with Julia and Christian Anto now, for the last couple of years. And, Christian, Christian, so I'm sure, he's yelling at me like, patience. And he's like poking him. Like, I'm like, ooh, like I can't fucking hold this any longer. Like, but that has just totally changed the way that I pull and how tight I get before I pull. And I used to be a lot more grip and rip and I would lose position upper back and same thing. I wouldn't be able to finish that lockout because I'm too rounded. I just didn't get high. I didn't start it with a good position because I wasn't patient enough. But I love what you talked about using blocks. It really does remind me of Olympic lifting. You know, a lot of Olympic lifting, you break down the movement, with blocks. And I would have never thought to use it in that sense where multiple, as you talk about different positioning, like that. So that's wonderful. And, so do you think that, let's say somebody's already deadlifting, sumo deadlifting a lot, and they, what are some, let's say somebody who has, struggles on their lockout from sumo, is there anything that you would be looking for and then also maybe implementing to help with that?
Well, if it's like what I talked about with with my sumo to where like I get, if I'm going to fail, it's going to be above the knee, which is super annoying because it's like, you're right there. Yes. You're right there.
Everybody else finishes this once it's above their shins. It's like,
So super annoying. So for someone like that, generally what the issue is like external rotation and your upper back is weaker than your lower body like that. And that's the main problem that I tend to have is I can pull it off the ground, no problem. And I have a good position off the ground, but then immediately my shoulders want to internally rotate because I don't have enough strength to hold that position up top. Mm-hmm. So, some things I like to program for that is I do focus on the external rotation, but that is a little bit harder to load specifically. So I will throw in like warmups of external rotation, like banded external shoulder rotations to kind of turn off the internal rotators by activating external rotation. I also am a big fan of like seated SSB good mornings. I think that those are great for building an upper, big upper back. I like heavy rows, like heavy cheat rows, anything that can really, really involve the upper back, I think is super, super beneficial to a sumo puller. If you're already strong off the floor, that's what you need to build is that position up top. So, you know, doing slow and controlled, like bent over rows is, that's great if you want aesthetics and if you want to, you know, have your back look nice. But at some point with powerlifting, you have to integrate all the muscles. You don't isolate, you have to integrate all the muscles. So I like heavy cheat rows. I like the seated SSB good mornings. I've been a really big fan of Trevor put waiter's walks in my program, and those really help. It's like just basically putting a kettlebell and walking with it overhead.
Yeah.
And that helps me to open up my thoracic spine. So that way I'm not so hunched over. Like I live at the computer all day. You know, I'm internally rotated all day. I work from a phone. I work from a computer. So those help me open up. So that way when I go to pull in my position, I can pop my sternum and my chest up.
Yeah.
So with a lifter who's having problems with that, I'm probably going to focus on like building that upper back strength and building that positional strength. It does come down to like a lot of self-cueing throughout the movement too. Like where I tend to fail is when I forget to pull my sternum up. Mm. So like when I'm deadlifting, once I get to my knee, I have to cue myself, like push your sternum up. So yeah, that's when I will pull my head to like look at, kind of like look at the ceiling a little bit, but not quite so high.
Yeah.
So that way I can lock out the movement because your head, your body follows your head.
Yeah.
So if you bring your head up a little bit, your sternum will generally come up with it too.
Yeah. Wonderful. I think those are great, great, great things that you can incorporate. And I see that a lot. Actually, I have one of my lifters. We both have the same problem. And we always laugh about it because she was probably one of the first people who started powerlifting at our gym. And I feel like, I'm like, I wonder if I screwed you up by giving you my habits because you seem to have the same problems that I have.
Sometimes that happens.
Yes.
You, like you end up seeing it so often that you kind of just, your body just does it. I don't know how to explain.
We don't train together though. You know, like I train her. We don't train together. Whereas like me and my husband, I had a lot of my husband's habits of training and I didn't realize it till, you know, years later. But I'm like, huh, like I used to make the biggest jumps and I used to just like, yeah, let me throw a plate. I mean, and then it wasn't until years later that I'm like, that's probably not a good idea for me. One, I don't weigh 270. So, all right, moving on to our next question. What would you implement for a new lifter that has issues flaring their elbows out on the press motion of the bench? And this is from emily.b.strong.
So this is pretty, I think this is pretty common, even not necessarily just in beginners, but a lot of this comes down to a little bit of lack of stability, I think, from the serratus. That is, it seems like it's a forgotten muscle. Like, I don't think that anyone knows how to train it or where it possibly is. It's basically like the little feathers where your, like right above your rib cage where your lats sit. It's kind of like a little bit more into your body, right? Basically the rib cage. And that is the cause for a lot of stability. Like the serratus kind of helps the lats stabilize. And once the lats are stable, then you can kind of press a little bit better. Right. So I do think that a lot of that comes down to serratus stability. You can train that with like, there are some push-up variations to where you can actually go like, it's called a push-up plus, mm-hmm. to where you push yourself up and you protract and everything. And that helps kind of strengthen the serratus. So a push-up plus is really beneficial for that. I do love torch presses. Also, those sound kind of exactly like what they are. You would grab a bottom of the dumbbell,
okay.
and you start with it to where your elbow is at your side, and you basically just raise the dumbbell up in front of you like you're raising up a torch, and it helps really. And you, so you think about protracting while you're pushing, and then raising it above head. I think I I've either posted a video or I promised Trevor I would post a video about them. So if I haven't already, it's on my list to do. So I will post those. But a torch press, I'm sure you can find a video on Google or on YouTube. But those have been really, really beneficial. Like that was a problem that I was having to where I would have, mine were uneven to where my right serratus and stabilizers were a little bit weaker than my left. So I would warm up with the torch presses and those really helped to kind of activate that. So that way when I would lay down on the bench, my lats felt like they could actually activate. I could feel them. So that's one thing that might possibly be happening if that is the case. Also, one thing I see a lot of is when a lifter sets up on the bench, they end up kind of being shrugged up.
Yeah.
Like even if they're arched or even if they don't have a crazy arch or anything like that, they are set up. And once they unrack the barbell and it's over their chest, it seems like their traps are touching their ears. And if you are shrugged up in a way, you're actually not activating any of your serratus, anything like that. So usually what I cue people is like an anti-shrug. So once they get on the bench, I think anti-shrug. So that way you push your shoulders down or like, you know, tuck your shoulders into your back pockets.
Yep.
Is another thing people will say too. And if you're shrugged up, that's when I see a lot of the flaring is because there is no stability. There is no lat tension. You're just trying to lift purely from your shoulders. So those are the first two without being able to see this person's like specific video on them flailing, you know, flaring their elbows. Those would be the first two things I would look at is work to improve like your serratus stability with like push up plus or torch presses. And then second, I would make sure that lifter is not shrugged up and they're actually thinking about pushing their shoulders down towards their back pockets or their heels.
Yeah. Position for sure. And I think without looking at any of these people's programs too, really taking a look at your program and seeing what other accessories are you putting in there to help with back stability, shoulder,
I feel like those are the best things to teach people that bench press isn't just dropping the bar down to your chest with an inverted row. Yeah. You have to pull yourself to the bar. So with the inverted rows, you take your bench grip and pull yourself to the bar. Cause that's what you should be doing when you bench. You should be pulling the bar into you and pulling yourself to the bar.
Yeah, for sure. Yes. And I think we, you know, as powerlifters in general, they haven't done any other sports or any other kind of training. It's very, you know, we're just going up and down, up and down. Yep. There is no rotation going on, right? And really, like, to be fair, there's probably, you know, you want less emphasis on some of those things because you're focusing so much on horizontal movement. But we do need to have, like, some variety in our training because we do have to live and live comfortably. And things like protraction is often not looked at when we're talking about the shoulders and serratus. So, like, having, like, rotating and protracting forward, like that is like unheard of, you know? And I'm pretty sure you guys do a lot of sort of like PRI concepts and postural restoration stuff, right? Like I think it might be called something different in how you guys are incorporated, but a lot of that can be some of these movements where we're protracted and reaching forward.
Some of those things get a little too deep, I think. For like, you know, like some of those things it just goes way over my head or like not applicable to powerlifting. But yeah, like the postural restoration stuff is like Trevor actually trained with a guy who really specializes in that for a while. So he learned a lot of movements from that. That goes back to like making sure that you're learning from everyone, because even though that this guy maybe, or this programming isn't super, I don't want to say it's not beneficial to powerlifting because obviously it is powerlifting, you know, beneficial, but it isn't your standard powerlifting thing. So he learned from it. But I mean, those things are when you press, like when you have to go from retraction to protraction, like you have to go through both those planes of motion. So being able to protract and actually activate your lats and your serratus, super beneficial, but most people don't think about that.
Right. Exactly. All right. So moving on to our last question, I love this one, is what is your purpose? And this is from Brit.ironsavages.fit. So what is your purpose?
With like powerlifting and coaching and everything, I think my purpose is to help people understand that the strength mostly comes from the mental, you know, like that has been kind of like the overarching, theme of most of the answers to this question today. And I think that in general, I do a pretty good job with helping people kind of unlock that part of themselves. you know, really realizing that if you don't believe in yourself, one, no one else is going to, and also you'll never actually reach your full potential. So I think with coaching and powerlifting and everything that I do, basically my whole purpose is to help people realize that your strength starts in your brain and you can't actually express it physically unless you're able to hone in on that mentally. You know, there's a reason why sports psychology has been a massive thing for so many years, because the psychology aspect of it is super, super important. It doesn't even matter that we're not Division I athletes, you know, like I get it that this is powerlifting. This isn't football or basketball or whatever, but this is a sport that we competitively, you know, do. So the psychology of it is super, super important. So I think that is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to help people figure out that they can be as strong as they want to be, but they just have to believe it.
Yeah. I love that. All right. So this is the final question. And this is what I ask all of our guests.
What the hell is wrong with you people?
What the hell was I thinking? Where you think back to a time in your powerlifting career and you think like, what the fuck was I doing that? Is there a time in your life where this has happened to you?
Oh man. That's such a good one.
We've had some great ones. We've had some very like knowledgeable ones and then some very like, I always use this one, but it's Anna, you know, Anna Perez. She used some like medical grade cream on her hip flexor that rolled down her body and eventually set her vagina on fire. So note to self is Greek yogurt is the solution. So if that ever happens, yeah, no milk, not all that Greek yogurt was the thing cut that.
Excellent to know. I wonder if sour cream would work the same way.
We'll have to find out. Somebody test that out and let us know. Someone else do it.
I think that like mine's not funny. Mine's a little bit more knowledgeable, I guess. But I think that in the beginning of coaching, I spent a lot of time trying to like. This is a common theme that has happened to me twice. So I've learned from it now because, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. I spent a lot of time helping other people grow and like helping other people expand their businesses and everything, because that is something that's really important to me is support, right? Supporting the people that support you, supporting people that are growing, trying to start off new business ventures and your friends and everything. And there were a couple times where I have supported some friends that they kind of turned around and were like, all right, thanks for your help. Goodbye. And weren't like the greatest of friends after that. So I spent a lot of time promoting other people and growing other people's businesses and passions and careers and stuff. And I focused less on my own because of that, because I was like, hey, I really, really want to support this person. They're, you know, very close to me. And so I took away from myself in order to help them. Yeah. And I learned from that twice. So going that's my, what the hell was I thinking kind of moment.
Yeah.
And going forward, I will probably never do that again. Like I will always be supportive of people, but I will never overextend myself anymore and take the focus away from my own growth to give other people their growth. So, yeah, that was a little deeper than vagina on fire, but no.
Both equally important, let me tell you. I think that's really important because, you know, I think there's a lot of us that if you're a caring person and you want to see other people grow, you know, and I've had many points in my life where I lose sight of that and it's exactly it. And then your kindness is, you know, taken advantage of pretty much. So I think that's something to think about as we move on, you know, in life, and that you really only can know these things until you've been screwed or the experience or something. Right. And cause then you're like, okay, never again.
Yeah. Especially when it happens to you twice and you're like, damn, I did it again.
Right. And it might happen again. Who knows? You know, like you're going to try not to let it happen, but I've had situations where that happened and I'm like, well, sometimes I'm glad I did try because it felt right for me in the moment, but I know that I'm probably going to stop a little short of where it might be assigned to me. So, well, Riley, thank you so much for joining me today. And these questions were phenomenal. I think everybody's going to learn from it. I think they're going to gather a lot, and you're a phenomenal coach and I'm glad to have you on. I got to have you on again because I think that we could really break down some things mentally. I think this is a great you know, people love when we talk about mental health and how that plays into training. So yeah, let's have you on again if that's something
you'd like.
Wonderful.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. This is great. I had a awesome time.